Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Howard Gardner is our guest this hour. He has a brand new book, and this should just be a really delightful conversation, Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed, Educating for the Virtues in the 21st Century. He says the book has two purposes. It's designed to help all of us think clearly about the current status of the three crucial human virtues and to offer suggestions to parents, teachers, and really everybody who ponder how we should educate across the generations. Howard, this book, actually, he says, came about because of a series of three lectures delivered in the autumn of 2008 at New York's Museum of Modern Art. And beauty and his need for beauty, our need for beauty, play a significant role in this book, as does the need for truth and goodness. So this should be one of those conversations you could only have on public radio, and it should be significant, I would think, because Howard Gardner is significant. He is the John H. and Elizabeth A. Hobbs Professor of Cognition and Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and Senior Director of the Harvard Project Zero. He's the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship and 27 honorary degrees. He's the author of more than 20 books, including Multiple Intelligences, Changing Minds, Intelligence Reframed, and Five Minds for the Future. And he joins us by phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Our phone number, I'm sure you'll want to join this conversation somewhere along the line, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Howard Gardner, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to talk with you.
Do you have, I imagine you right now pictured at your desk with perhaps some impressionist paintings in front of you. Is there beauty around you somewhere, sir?
Actually, I'm in my office, whereas the impressionist paintings are at home.
Ah.
But I am looking at a Miro lithograph and a Rothko poster. So these are two middle 20th century works, and they're ones that have meaning for me. But like many people nowadays, I find my taste changing over time, and that's one of the things that I write about when I talk about beauty. I think in an earlier era, we were much more likely to canonize certain things as being beautiful, and other things would be ignored. And I think that's no longer the best way to think about the arts or nature. So I put forth a different way of thinking about beauty. And an analogy which I think might be helpful is to think about food. When you're 10 or 12 years old, there's certain things you like, and presumably you continue to like most of those things. But almost anybody now who lives in an NPR community, shall we say, you know, by the time they're 30 or 40 or 50, will have tasted different cuisines, whether it's East Asian or Southern European or Latin American. And that will probably continue to change as you explore new kinds of food, and that's great. And that doesn't mean you don't like burgers anymore or you don't like milkshakes or Dunkin' Donuts, but you're pretty restricted if what you liked when you were a kid is the only thing you like now. And I think in the 21st century world, where we're exposed to music and plays and paintings and sculpture and buildings all over the world, they're at our fingertips, we're going to have continuously evolving notions of what beauty is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fine.
Yeah, and we'll talk much more about beauty because I found your observations of paintings and the observations of your wife, who is an artist, really interesting. But let's start with the whole idea of your caring so deeply about what you call something that is fundamental to our condition as human beings and has been so for thousands of years. Why are these three virtues crucial to who we are?
In my own case, I didn't discover this until after the book came out, but in the school that I went to, the secondary school, the motto of the school was Verum Pulchrum Bonum, truth, beauty, and goodness. So you might say that when I went to Wyoming Seminary and Pennsylvania in the 1950s, my brain was already washed with those ideas. But actually, if you take a look at any classical culture, whether it's Western or Asian or matter Islamic, there is a concern for morality and ethics. There's a concern for what sorts of objects and experiences we value. And there's certainly a concern for what kind of statements we make and have validity and which ones don't. And about a dozen years ago, I published a book called The Disciplined Mind. And in that book, I argued that formal education should help us to decide what's true and what's not, what's beautiful and what's not, what's good and what's not. But I wrote about that very naively. I guess I wrote about it like the man on the street or the professor on the street, where I kind of assumed, well, everybody knows what's true, everybody knows what's beautiful, and everybody knows what's good, and we just need to inculcate that. So I was kind of in canonical about that myself. But then in the intervening dozen years or so, I realized that it was unacceptably naive. And it was naive both because of philosophical considerations on the one hand, and about technological ones on the other. And that's the 21st century aspect of the book. So when I talk about philosophical, anybody who is alive and awake nowadays knows about the assertion that it's very hard to figure out what's true. There, we have very so many different claims being made. And truth is often who's got the microphone, who's got the power.
Yes.
When it comes to goodness, well, I may know what's good for me, but I shouldn't judge other people, let alone people who live in other kinds of societies. And these are what are called postmodern and relativist critiques, and people may not use those terms, but everybody's familiar with the idea, well, that's your taste, that's fine, or that's your morality, that's fine, but don't confuse it with mine. Then when you turn to technology, certainly the digital media were available in the 80s and when I developed the ideas of the disciplined mind, but nobody had even thought about the web yet, let alone social networks, let alone Wikipedia and so on. And yet nowadays we live in that world, the world of Facebook, the world of the internet, and when anything can be posted at any time, anything can be changed at any time, any work of art can be posted and can be morphed and transformed and flickered and photoshopped and so on. And what I've been spending the most time on myself, when all sorts of traditional notions of what is private, what does it mean to own something, how do you trust people, all of that's being completely uprooted by the digital media, I figured I couldn't continue to praise truth, beauty, and goodness unless I had a conversation with myself about what it is that those terms meant. And so by a set of circumstances, I had an opportunity some years ago to give some lectures at the museum about truth, beauty, and goodness. And without quite knowing it, that was sort of a dress rehearsal for whether I could write a book on the topic. And I guess I came to the conclusion that that's what I do. I write books. So hence the truth, beauty, and goodness reframed.
And I'm so glad you did. There's nothing more worthwhile, I would think, for somebody like you to write a book like this. It's just right
it's
up your alley,
book,
isn't it?
Kathleen.
I yes.
Mean, I don't know to whom it will speak, either in this country or abroad, but I had the opportunity to say what would really meant the most to me, and that's a wonderful opportunity we have.
Yeah. Well, it prompted a conversation in my family last night with our son and my husband, and we just started talking about goodness, and I thought, isn't this great? We're talking about goodness in our living room instead of, you know, the Milwaukee Bucks playing basketball again. It was good. Let's, because we're on the radio right now, and because I consider it, although we entertain so many different points of view and different versions of truth, it's a kind of an open forum here, but every now and then you feel as though you're really on to some kind of major truth when you do a show like this. And I want you to talk about, as you do in the book, journalism. You, and I'm probably of a similar age, grew up in a time when, as you say, CBS Evening News delivered the authoritative truth about the world. Walter Cronkite ended his broadcast with "That's the way it is." We are now, I think, living in this age that you call an age of propaganda. So what we're hearing on the radio, a lot of stations, is this is my version of the truth, and getting people riled up to believe whatever the version of the truth is. Why has that happened in our society, and is there a role for very highly educated journalists to do their craft and to present? Do they have an obligation to present some version of the truth, and how do we know that they're onto it?
Well, the short answer is yes, yes. But let's talk about what was good about the old days, and let's talk about what was not good about the old days. What was good about the old days was that journalists had a view that they should be disinterested. Disinterested doesn't mean bored. It meant they should try to put their biases and values aside as much as possible. It's hard for us nowadays even to believe this, but many journalists did not vote in the 1950s because they felt it would compromise their objectivity and their disinterestedness. And the idea was to probe, but to probe without trying to tilt toward one side or the other. That's what was good about, we might say, mid-century journalism in the U.S. and in other free and democratic societies. What was bad was that there were very few outlets. There were basically three networks in the United States, and they determined what it was that was fit to print or fit to broadcast. And things like Franklin Roosevelt's Paralysis or John Kennedy's Affairs were seen to be off base, and so they couldn't be broadcast. Now, if we fast forward 50 years, what is good is that there's no opinion known to man or woman anywhere which isn't posted somewhere. But there's a lack of understanding that one ought to try very hard to transcend our biases, transcend our interests, and get the story correct. And I'm going to use two examples which are probably not terribly controversial to your audience, the New York Times and the National Public Radio. I can critique both of those entities, because that's what I live on every day, but I think the goal in each case is to get it right. And I'm going to use Israel-Palestine as an example. Whenever the New York Times covers Israel-Palestine, or whenever NPR covers it, they're deluged with complaints about equally from the whatever the left is and whatever the right is, and that makes us unhappy in a certain sense, but it means we're probably getting the story more or less as accurately as we can. There is what you might call a pseudo-disinterestedness, which is very bad, and many people in the media talk about this, and let's take the case of climate change. You know, if you ask 3,000 scientists who know something about geology, atmosphere, weather, carbons, and so on, you're going to find 2,950 who say there definitely is climate change. Moreover, the chances that there's a human contribution are about 99.99%. Being good journalism does not mean we take the program and we devote 50% of the time to these 99.9% scientists and the other 50% of the time to people from obscure places with pseudo degrees who denounce it. And yet, sometimes people feel that's what journalism should shoot for.
Yes.
So even though I have a lot to say about the three topics, I have a fairly simple solution for each. And in the case of truth, number one, I think the chances of figuring out what's really going on now are greater than at any time in human history because nothing is hidden. It's all out there. But to establish what's true and what's not, we have to learn about the methods that are used by people who make assertions. So a blogger can say anything that he or she wants, and that's fine. But a journalist for the New York Times can't say everything that he or she wants. It's checked and fact-checked, and if it's wrong, the next day there's an erratum published, or the public editor writes about it on Sunday, and if a person does it too much, they lose their job. And we actually keep track of how many mistakes everybody makes. If we're a blogger, that's not appropriate, and it shouldn't be done. But I think anybody who wants to be a reasonable citizen in our society has to understand the difference between researched, disinterested journalism on the one hand, the methods that are used by a good journalist, and those used by a blogger who may be fine and may have lots of hits, but is just shooting off his or her mouth.
Right.
And of course, we have the same thing happening now with regard to the election, where truth has been replaced in many cases by what Stephen Colbert calls truthiness, which is you say what you feel, you repeat it often enough, and it gets a kind of a pseudo-truth value, but in fact, there's no method, nobody's researched the thing. I mean, the most flagrant example is the notion that Obama wasn't born in the United States, but on all sides, people are making assertions with no particular truth value, and unless we understand the difference between taking a quote out of context, which a politician made, and taking one with full context and reporting the full thing, then we're at the mercy of the last person who's had the mic or the last person who's posted something on Facebook.
And then they just waste our time, and it keeps going on, and they're wasting our precious lives.
Well, obviously, those of us who spend time doing this we're complicit, and you know, let me put it this way. Media outlets which want to maintain audiences have to provide material which the audiences want to be exposed to, because we can't force people to read or to listen to or to watch something they don't want to. So the challenge for any serious medium is to present things so compellingly that people will not only attend to it, but will say this was time well spent. One of the interesting things from our own research, and this is our research at Harvard Project Zero, is that most people of all ages feel that they spend much too much time on the Internet, much too much time surfing, but they don't feel that they're able to stop because it's a little bit like a narcotic.
Yes, it is.
And nobody can make you stop. You have to discipline yourself in a certain way, and that's part of a democratic society. I mean, in a totalitarian society, you can prohibit certain things from being broadcast, and indeed, you could penalize people for not listening to the Soviet Union news or the fascist Germany news. But we're in a free society. There's a competition in the marketplace, and if people want to hear more about Kim, whatever her last name is, Kardashian.
Oh, let's just forget her. Right,
then,
I know.
Then Hillary Clinton and Myanmar, which we just heard about,
right,
in the 11 o'clock news. We can't force that. But there are interesting programs on news literacy being done now in upper elementary school grades and high school, and there's a big program now at Stony Brook in New York State where young people are exposed to how news is researched and made, and learn to see the difference between something which is well-researched as opposed to something simply passed on from the Internet, or in the worst case, something made up or just tweak somebody else's coverage. And I think that's necessary. Unfortunately, most of us learn the hard way if something said about us is totally untrue, but it would be nice if we didn't have to go through that ourselves, if we actually learned the methods for ascertaining
mm-hmm.
truth.
Yeah.
And just to repeat on the positive side, the chances of actually figuring out what's going on now are greater than any time in human history mm-hmm. if we're willing to take the time to figure out how did people come to the assertions that they did.
And before we get to beauty, let's talk about history for a moment. How do we need to study history? Can history help us ascertain truth, or is it problematic in its own right?
Well, the interesting thing about history as opposed to science is the following. In science, people make an observation or carry out an experiment, and they then conclude they report what they found, and then what makes something scientific is if other people find the same thing. And if they don't, it gets thrown into the falsehood dust heap. And over time, we understand the physical world, the biological world, the social world better as a result of science. History only happened once, and we can't repeat the experiment. And so, you know, there are certain factual things which aren't so difficult to establish. You know, I mean, John Kennedy was killed on November 22nd, 1963, and Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin. There's still some people who think that there were more than one, but there's really no evidence that there was more than one. But the other thing about history, Kathleen, is every generation rewrites history, because you can't rewrite history without knowing about your own time. So let's take the history of the Roman Empire. There have been hundreds of histories of the Roman Empire. If you'd written the history of the Roman Empire in the United States 100 years ago, it wouldn't be the same as the history today of the Roman Empire. And that's not because we know so much more. It's because today the United States is the Roman Empire, and you couldn't possibly think about the Roman Empire without thinking about the United States. So in that sense, history is more fickle than science. But in each case, what's important, and this is what I think schools will be doing increasingly in the future, is telling us how do historians work. What data do they use? What sources do they use? When do they change their own mind about things? An example which recently caught my attention is that there's all sorts of stories around about the reason that Harry Truman dropped the atomic bomb. And the story until recently was that the Japanese wouldn't surrender otherwise, and then we would lose many, many American lives. Well, there's now a new line of argument that actually Japan didn't surrender because of an atomic weapon. They surrendered because of the Soviet Union entering the war with millions of other soldiers, and they knew they could never defeat them. Now, we can't do the experiment. We can't go back to 1945, but historians will now argue over the next years about whether this new hypothesis about why Japan surrendered in August of 45 has a lot of evidence for it, or whether it's just some kooky idea. And so in that sense, I think history also progresses, but it's not nearly as linear, because it's about human beings and our intentions and motivations, and it's about the time in which human beings are currently living, as well as the time, whether it's the Roman Empire or Germany 1945, which is different from our time today. If you're studying DNA, you're studying chemical bonds, they don't change.
Howard Gardner, our guest, and we haven't even gotten yet to beauty and goodness, so imagine what's ahead. He's the author of Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed, Educating for the Virtues in the 21st Century. Our phone number, we'll get to a couple of your calls right after we pause for a moment. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls for Howard Gardner, and let's start with Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Marvelous topic, marvelous guest.
He's not bad, is he?
I have a personal confession, which is that I suffer from having been or being a Scottish Presbyterian. So, and perhaps your guest suffers from a Catholic education, and I often think they're equivalent. but more seriously, would the guest prefer to comment on perhaps the fact that the 20th century is not original, that we're in the situation that 5th century Athens was, where those would say the truth is what you choose to believe, or make arguments from power alone, and there was the gentleman who wandered the streets and asked questions, a rational skeptic position, and one should ask how one knows what one thinks one knows before you make positive or extreme statements. And thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank.
Okay, well, I'm neither a Roman Catholic or a Scottish Presbyterian, but if anything, if I can continue the religious thing for a moment, I do think that I'm a product of the Protestant Revolution, as described particularly by Max Weber, the famous sociologist of a century ago, in that I believe that certain professions like science or journalism are callings, and they're callings in the sense that you have a certain responsibility if you're a scientist or a doctor or a journalist or a historian. And your obligation is to try to get things as right as you can, knowing that you can never achieve perfection, but you should keep that disinterested vocation or calling in mind. And I think that's what impels me. As to the particular example you raised, you're absolutely right. In any relatively free society, and Athens was relatively free in the 4th and 5th century, you have discussions about these issues. And, you know, Plato and Aristotle argued mightily about whether scientific things, whatever that meant at the time, were a priori or whether they were empirical. And Aristotle was the empiricist. He went out and looked at stuff and classified it and tried to get it right. And it lasted pretty well for 1,000 years. But I doubt that Plato, who was his teacher, was convinced. You know, Plato thought the answers were in these absolute ideal forms and not in anything which you had to go out and actually do observations in the world about. In fact, the observations would just show you the shadows in the cave, not the reality, which was an ideal. So from a historian, a philosophy or historian of scientific perspective, you're right. These are things which have been debated perennially. The beauty was certainly debated in the Middle Ages. It was debated in the Renaissance, and it continues to be debated today. So why revisit this in the 21st century? Number one, because I think the critiques now are not critiques that are just restricted to intellectuals in ivory towers. You go to any group of 17 or 18-year-olds who are reasonably educated, and they will throw both the postmodern and the relativist critique at you, whether or not they've heard those terms. And by the same token, the ease of posting anything and changing anything and valorizing anything is something which couldn't have been conceived even 25 years ago in the days of three networks, a couple of newspapers and magazines, and leaders whose authority was hardly questioned. So I'm giving you a perhaps lengthier answer than I should be, but I guess if I had to summarize it in a sentence, I would say this. The debates about truth, beauty, and goodness are perennial, but we always have to confront them in our own era, and that's why my subtitle is In the 21st Century. I kind of wish the subtitle had been Educating for the Virtues in the Era of Truthiness in Twitter, because I think that's more vivid, but
you're right.
I'll have to wait for the paperback.
Yeah, you're right. It is a better title. Frank, thanks as always. Let's move to beauty for just a moment before we go back to our many phone calls, and we do have our lines jammed on this. I know you're an esteemed educator as well. What concerns me, because I think that all of us have a desire to visit art museums, to take a vacation and go look at mountains or go contemplate a seashore or whatever it is we find that's beautiful. What concerns me a lot about what's happening with education, as you well know, is we're getting so narrow. You have to learn this in English. You have to learn this in math, and forget history, forget art completely, forget dance and music and all that gives our lives some zing. I mean, it's almost like an addiction for me and for many people. You have to see it every now and then so you feel at peace with the world, so you feel inspired by the world. Can you talk about what's happening with beauty and also these three antecedent experiences of beauty, which I found very interesting in your book?
Sure. Well, first of all, some people have said to me, well, truth and goodness is important, and, beauty just doesn't have the same importance. And I say, well, look, I agree in the sense that, it's more important to have a roof over your house and to have food in your tummy and to feel secure than to go to an art museum or listen to music that you want to hear. But most of the people that I know and most of the people who are listening here are lucky enough that, we do have a place to live and we do know where our next meal is coming from. And then you have to ask about what makes life worth living. And I think it's having experiences which we value. And just as truth is about propositions, beauty is about experiences. And as you pointed out, Kathleen, I have my own definition of what beautiful experiences are, and it's pretty simple. Beautiful experiences are ones which are interesting, they capture our attention. Two, they're memorable, and the form is memorable. We don't just label it, but we can actually recreate it. And three, we want to have those experiences again. And that's very important because there are things which are vivid and memorable, but they're so awful that we don't want to visit them again, and I wouldn't want to use the word beauty. There are things that are interesting, but they're so similar to what we've experienced before that we don't want to revisit them anymore. So I nowadays use the word beauty for any experience, whether it's a conversation or a trip on a boat or on a bicycle or a visit to some kind of a building or some kind of a performance where it interests us. We find its forms memorable, and we'd like to have it again. That's what beauty is. And the wonderful thing about beauty is that everybody can have his or her own concept of beauty, and it doesn't make a whit of difference. With truth, we can't live in a society where everybody thinks has a different set of truths. We'd go nuts. But just like we can all say, well, I like this kind of food and not that kind of food, or I used to like this kind of food, but now I've switched to that kind of food, and it doesn't impinge on anybody else except maybe what we have for dinner tonight. So to speak, if I like Mahler and I don't like the Rolling Stones, or vice versa, and if you like Andy Warhol and I'd rather look at Velasquez, or you want to go to see and hear Lady Gaga and I'd rather hear Placido Domingo, that's fine. And we can post what we like. We can try to convince other people. I only have actually one characteristic, which I talk about in the book, and that is I'm not going to take your likes of beauty very seriously if you can't somehow demonstrate to me the difference between something you consider beautiful and something you don't. So if you're doing strictly randomly or strictly in terms of how much money it's worth, then I'm not going to take your distinctions of beauty very seriously. But, and this is where you're referring to my wife, who is trained as an artist. When she went to see an exhibit at the museum in New York by Matthew Barney, who's a contemporary artist, and she said, this is really beautiful. And then the curator of the museum, Connie Butler, also said, this is really beautiful. Something which I hadn't been able to make any sense of. I said, well, you know, they think it's beautiful. I ought to pay attention to why. And they were able to describe to me how it was, what they valued and how it was different from other works by other people. And even though I didn't sign up and say, well, I think this is beautiful, I had an appreciation that they had reasons for saying what they were saying. And if you ask me about arts education, I would say there are really two things that are important. One is that you can see or hear differences. And number two, that you assemble your own portfolio of what you like and what you and what you value, what you consider to be beautiful. The portfolio can be physical. You can actually collect stuff. It can be virtual. It can be, you know, online. You can have the Kathleen Dunn portfolio of plays that you love. Or it can even be in your own mind. You know, it doesn't even have to be virtual. It can be in your brain. If I were a teacher in the arts, I would bring works to the attention of kids that I value and why. I'd like to try to show them why I value this and not that. But that would bring other people in with other values, bring my wife in with Matthew Barney and have her explain why she likes it or not. And then I would encourage you, no differently than if you kept a list of recipes you like or restaurants you like, keep a list of the stuff that you value, whether it's visual or auditory or musical or linguistic or whatever.
I love that idea.
And just cherish it.
I love that idea. What a great idea that is. And then you can bring them to mind whenever you would like. Whenever you would like. There it is. That's a great idea. Tell me about, before we go back to phone calls, your own experience. You're looking at this, and it took you a little while to really appreciate the beauty in this, and it's sort of hard to understand how anybody would, but you will explain it so we'll all understand it. The Canadian artist with the snow falling on the typewriter.
Well, I have to say that was much easier for me than the deportment of the host by Matthew Barney. But you know, there's the work that you're referring to by Rodney Graham is a film of an old typewriter which he found in the last years, but it had been made in Germany before the Second World War, so it was an old manual typewriter, and he somehow got the idea of leaving it outside, and it was then slowly covered by snow. So in the beginning you see the typewriter, and over the course of some minutes it gets to be covered by snow, so it's almost completely covered. You can just see, you know, the outlines of the typewriter, and it's on a it's displayed on something you don't see anymore, an old rickety or ratchety 16-millimeter projector. So you're watching this thing in an old projector, just kind of like an old movie. I haven't seen the new Martin Scorsese movie, Hugo, but I get that's also about old photography and films, and I have a warm spot for that, being pretty old myself. And I just, so to speak, grooved on that experience. And what's the test? I went back several times to see it again, and to me that's the acid test. It's an experience you value enough that you want to see, and I brought my wife and my kids, and I can't make them like it. If they don't like it, it's great, but I think some of them did, and now I've written about it, and Mr. Graham was nice enough to give me permission to reproduce the photographs so people can at least take a look in the book and see whether they have the same rocks. But it doesn't matter. What matters is that the sorts of things that somebody does and tells you about stimulates you to look at it or to listen to it and make your own point of it, to make your own conclusion, and nobody's hurt by it.
Right. John in Ashland, hi.
Hi. I'm really interested in your definition of truth. But what intrigues me is my wife and I lived in Kenya, and when we understood what we thought was a truthful history of America and our involvement there, and then we talk about the same topic from their perspective. So their perspective was diametrically opposed to ours. We both were basing our assumptions, our fact gathering on always on fact, or our assumption of truth on fact. How do we really define truth? Who gets to decide what is truthiness? And is there always going to be some assumption that there's going to be some level of subjectivity to the definition of truth? And how do we deal with that?
Well, I think you're right. History is more difficult than physics, and it's easier to have an authoritative physics textbook, so let's say about Newtonian mechanics, than an authoritative textbook about the French Revolution. But let's use your particular example. If I were an historian, and let's say we're talking about the United States in the post-World War II era, if there are two very competing narratives, one which might say the United States is bumbling but trying to do the right thing, and the other one is saying, you know, the United States was on the wrong side of every particular dispute, I think you take a look at this assertion case by case. You know, the Marshall Plan is very different from the Belgian Congo, which is very different from Vietnam, and you try to figure out in each case what was the motive, what happened, what were the positive consequences, what were the negative consequences, and then you have a more rounded, and I would say more veridical, that's the word we use for truthfulness, picture of the United States in the post-World War II era than either an American glorification narrative, which you might get an old-fashioned textbook, which would be popular in certain states, or an America as villainous textbook, which might be popular in a very different kind of society. So I think one can get closer to a version of what's true over time if you take a look at the competing narratives and see how much evidence there is for each, and you avoid the sin of presentism. Presentism means, let's take the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the end of the Second World War, which we were talking about. Now, maybe with hindsight, maybe that was a bad idea, and it shouldn't have been done. It should have been done differently. But when you're doing history, you can't do hindsight. You've got to put yourself in the mind of the commander-in-chief of the American Army, which is the president. He's just come to power. There's been a terrible world war where many lives from many countries have been lost over the last 5 or 6 years. And you have to say, given the knowledge that he had at the time, was his decision a reasonable one? And I think we can come up with a better answer to that than we could have, right the day afterwards. But we can't rewrite history just to reflect what we think about today, because there are all sorts of consequences which couldn't have been anticipated. And that's what I would tend to do with the example that you talked about. I hope that's helpful.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much, John, for the call. Howard Gardner is our guest this hour, author of a wonderful new book, Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed, Educating for the Virtues in the 21st Century. We have, some of you might say it's the most important of the virtues, goodness. We have yet to get to goodness, and we will, my goodness, in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have a great email coming up as well. So join us if you'd like in the minutes that remain. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to an email from Lori Howard. What would it look like for a family to study the good, true, and beautiful with after-school hours? Does it look like a classical education, Latin, classics, literature, logic?
I don't think that the kind of education I'm talking about has to take place at a certain time of the day. I don't think it has to take place using a certain kind of a classical background, whether it's classical Latin or Greek or, let's say, Europe of the the 18th century. I think what's most important is that the materials that the teacher uses and the way that the teacher, whether it's a live teacher or an online teacher or group of teachers, the way that they approach these materials show a concern with the underlying aspects of truth, beauty, and goodness. So let me be specific. When it comes to truth, I think the important thing for the teacher to do is to focus on the methods people use, whether they're making scientific assertions or historical assertions, or whether they're practicing journalism or engineering or architecture. So I think the focus there needs to be in method. And that's new, because so much of our education till the 21st century was just about getting facts and information. But everybody who has a handheld has that, can access that out immediately. So it's a complete waste of time to sit and memorize the kings or the presidents or the wars, because it's all there. But how do we know that it's true? What's the evidence? That's the stuff that doesn't come from having an access to Google. When it comes to beauty, I think we begin with the experiences of every day, but then we move to experiences which have been valued by people today and in the past, literary experiences, experiences of nature, experiences of graphic arts, indicate why we value them, but encourage people to make their own comparisons and say what it is that they value. And when it comes to goodness, and I think Kathleen's going to ask me about that frontally in a moment, goodness is about relations. It's about relationships we have with other human beings whom we know. And increasingly in the digital era, it's relationships with people whom we only know virtually, whom we only know online. And that has to be part of a community. The only way in which we can learn to be good in the sense of being good people, good workers, good citizens, is to be in a community where that kind of goodness is valued, and where people who violate a sense of goodness, people who have toxic relations with one another, are first warned against it, but eventually ostracized, whether it's an online community or a school or a neighborhood, because you can't have decent relationships if there's too much toxicity. And we were talking earlier about the media today, and I think one of the problems with what passes for journalism nowadays is toxicity. Noise is much too powerful, and trying to get the story right without raising your voice unnecessarily is hard to hear. I listen to NPR, as obviously you all do. I value the Friday at 5 when you have a conversation between David Brooks and E.J. Dionne.
I do, too. I love that segment.
Because they don't have the same point of view, but they listen to one another, and they talk civilly. If you turn TV, David Brooks is on there too, talking to Mark Shields. So he's the right wing for every occasion. But we need to have those kind of models of how you can relate to people who you don't agree with without screaming one another, which is what so much of the both the Fox and the anti-Fox networks do.
We'll get more on goodness in a moment, but I need to go to Jeff from River Falls. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Gene. Thank you for taking my call. See, I had the good fortune to enjoy a car ride to and from the airport with Professor Gardner when he visited us over here in River Falls.
Oh, great.
This morning. And here's my question. I'm thinking about C.S. Lewis's doctrine of objective value quite a bit these days, this notion that good or truth deserves our reverence because it just exists. It deserves our emotional commitment because it exists within something like a Tao or a set of principles that don't need to be validated because they're self-existent. And then sort of pitting that against the relativistic notion that there is no instantiation of goodness at all, because anything we come up with is going to fall short of that kind of an ideal. And I'm wondering, my question, Howard, is what about truth existing literally in the tension between those two extremes?
Well, I agree that those extremes are untenable. Where I think I disagree with your description of Lewis, whose work I really don't know well enough, is I think we can't assume there are a priori truths. Truths have to be established by using the best methods that we can ascertain. Because if you hold truth A and I hold truth not A, we've got a standoff. But if I then say, well, tell me why you hold A, and I'll tell you why I hold not A, there's at least a chance of figuring out what the truth is. I mean, if we take the big arguments nowadays, is it true that if we tax very wealthy people, that this will harm the economy? You know, you have two different assertions. So I'm not interested in the assertions. I'm interested in what's the evidence if we look at the tax structure over the last 70 years. Most people who are listening to the radio won't believe that when John Kennedy came into the office, the marginal tax rate was 91% for people who made over a certain amount of money. The economy didn't collapse. That's very important to know when somebody says, well, you know, if we raise taxes, we're going to destroy our economy. So it's getting the evidence which leads to that confident assertion of truth, which is what I rely on. And so that's in between I know truth and I don't need to, don't bother with me the evidence, or truth is out of the question, everybody's got his own point of view. If either of those were the case, I don't think we could have a viable society. So we have to slog along with our methods and try to convince people using the best evidence that we can.
Thanks, Jeff, for the call. I don't want this hour to go by without talking about, I don't know, maybe they're somewhat interchangeable, kindness, but certainly goodness. Do we need to go much beyond do unto others?
Yes, we do. Do unto others, and indeed the Ten Commandments, are about how we deal with people whom we see every day, people in the neighborhood, and that's great. But in a modern complex society, there are two other roles. One is the role of the professional, the doctor, the lawyer, the teacher, the engineer, the architect, the accountant, the auditor, and the role of citizen of Wisconsin, where I gather you may recall your governor, citizen of the United States, citizen of the planet, because we're all citizens of the planet. And the Bible and the Golden Rule are not going to help us answer those very complicated questions of what it means to be a good surgeon or a good teacher, because issues like abortion or stem cell research, issues like when you're a teacher and a new edict comes in from the government that you should teach in a certain way and you don't like that way of teaching, you can't get those answers from the Bible or the Ten Commandments. You have to vote upon a certain tax for your neighborhood, and on the one hand, you don't like that tax, but on the other hand, maybe it'll help people who are less fortunate than you. You're not going to get the answer from the Bible or from the Golden Rule. So I call in the book for the establishment of commons. And these are common spaces where people within a profession or within an organization, it could be a school, it could be a university, it could be a company, can talk about these issues quite frankly, say how they've dealt with them, and ask for other people what they would do. And in fact, by total coincidence, I did this just this morning.
Oh, you did?
At Harvard, we're supposed to teach 4 days a week, and then we have a fifth day off. And I wrote a confessional blog, not yet posted, where I said, you know, I made 3 international trips this term, and I met all my classes, and I went to all my faculty meetings, but I certainly wasn't in my office for four days a week. Did I do wrong? And I said, what does it mean to be full-time in the 21st century when you can do so much online? You can even teach by Skype, though I always teach in person, but I often respond to my students online. And this is nothing, Kathleen, or our questioner, which we can get from the Bible, because the Bible didn't know about doing email or doing Skype. It's things we have to tackle with people who are well-meaning and informed and don't just have an axe to grind. So to summarize what we talked about today, in the area of truth, the focus has to be in methods. How do people support the truth that they claim? In beauty, it's wide open. We each of us can put forth our own portfolios. We just need to know why they are. In the area of goodness, it's really developing common spaces. And you know, at the risk of praising NPR again, it's one of the few common spaces where people can disagree without being disagreeable, and we can all learn from those kinds of spaces. And it's the same that so much available in the media now is either pablum or so much screaming that there's no chance to sit back and to say, well, you know, I hadn't thought about this, and maybe I should rethink my position.
Yeah. Do you spend a good portion of your day thinking about these virtues and acting on them in some way?
Well, for the last 15 years, actually more than that, 16 years now, my major work has been in good, what I call good work and good citizenship.
I love that.
And with my colleagues, Wendy and Lynn and other people, we've created something called the Good Work Toolkit. And if you go to goodworktoolkit.org, you can read about the toolkit. If you go to goodworkproject.org, you can read about the project. And what we're really trying to do is to help people who are well-meaning and well-intentioned. A lot of people are not evil, but often they're not doing things which is good work or good citizenship because they don't know how or because they're embarrassed to discuss their problems. I've just revealed on the air something where I feel a bit guilty because I'm not there 4 days a week, but right. I'd like to know how people handle this sort of thing. And so I guess my answer is yes, I think about this all the time. I try to make myself a positive model, but I also try to share my own uncertainties, and if somebody can come up with a response to what I wrote, that would be great.
Yeah. Howard, thank you so much. I love the hour and the book. Thanks.
Thank you, and thank you. Very good questioners and listeners, and special hello to Jeff.
Howard Gardner, Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed, Educating for the Virtues in the 21st Century. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Think about that interview for quite some time, huh? Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of your calls. We just couldn't, but we'll keep doing shows.